Hi, DWA. Let's talk about dinosaurs. The following description of the Brontosaurus skeleton in the American Museum was first published in the American Museum Journal of April 1905. The Brontosaurus skeleton, the principal feature of the hull, is 66 feet 8 inches long. The weight of the animal when alive was estimated by W.K. Gregory at 38 tons. About one-third of the skeleton, including the skull, is restored in plaster model or cast from other incomplete skeletons. The remaining two-thirds belong to one individual, except for a part of the tail, one shoulder blade, and one hind limb, supplied from another skeleton of the same species. The skeleton was discovered by Mr. Walter Granger of the Museum Expedition of 1898, about 9 miles north of the Medicine Bow, Wyoming. Took the whole of the succeeding summer to extract it from the rock, pack it, and ship it to the museum. Nearly 2 years were consumed in removing the matrix, piecing together and cementing the brittle and shattered petrified bone, strengthening it so that it would bear handling, and restoring the missing parts of the bone in tint and plaster. The articulation and mounting of the skeleton and modeling of the missing bones took an even longer time, so it was not until February of 1905 that the Brontosaurus was at last ready for exhibition. It will appear, therefore, that the collection, preparation, and mounting of this gigantic fossil had been the task of extraordinary difficulty. No museum has ever before attempted to mount such a large fossil skeleton, and the great weight and fragile character of the bones made it necessary to devise special methods to give the bone a rigid and complete support, as otherwise it would soon break in pieces from its own weight. The proper articulating of the bones and posing of the limbs were equally difficult problems, for the amphibious dinosaurs, to which this animal belongs, disappeared from the earth long before the dawn of the age of mammals and their nearest relatives. The living lizards, crocodiles, etc., are so remote from them in either proportions or habitats that they are unsatisfactory guides in determining how the bones were articulated, and are of but little use in posing the limbs and other parts of the body in positions that they must have in positions that they must have taken during life. Nor among the higher animals of the modern times is there one which has any analogy in appearance or habit of life close or habits of life to those which we have been obliged by the study of the skeleton to ascribe to the Brontosaurus. As far as the backbone and ribs were concerned, the articulating surfaces of the bones were a sufficient guide to enable us to pose this part of the skeleton properly. The limb joints, however, are so imperfect that we could not in this way make sure of having the bones in a correct position. The following method, therefore, was adopted. A dissection and thorough study was made by the writer with the assistance of Mr. Granger of the limbs of alligators and other reptiles in the position, size, and action of the principal muscles were carefully worked out. The then corresponding bones of the Brontosaurus were studied, and the position and size of the corresponding muscles were worked out, so as far as they could be recognized from the scars and the processes preserved on the bone. The Brontosaurus limbs were then provisionally articulated and posed, and the position and size of each muscle was represented with a broad strip of paper extending from its origin to its insertion. The action and play of the muscles on the limb of the Brontosaurus could then be studied, and the bones adjusted until a proper and mechanically correct pose was reached. The The limbs were then permanently mounted in these poses, and the skeleton, as it stands, is believed to represent, as nearly as the study of the fossil enables us to know, a characteristic position of the animal that the animal actually assumed during life. In proportions and appearance, the Brontosaurus was quite unlike any living animal. It had a long, thick tail like the lizards and crocodiles, a long, flexible neck like an ostrich. Oh, fuck. Oh. And a thick, oh, fuck, short, slab-sided body and straight, massive post-like limbs suggesting the elephant, and a remarkably small head for the size of the beast. The ribs, limb bones, and tail bones are exceptionally solid and heavy. The vertebrae on the back of the neck and the skull, on the contrary, are constructed so as to combine the minimum weight with the large surface necessary for the attachment of huge muscles. Oh, fuck. The largest possible... Weight with the large surface necessary for the attachment of the huge muscles and the largest possible articulating surfaces and the necessary strength at all points of strain. For this purpose, they are constructed with an elaborate system of braces and buttresses, with thin bony plates connecting the broad articulating surfaces and muscular attachments. Oh, shit. All of the bone between these thin plates being hollowed into a complicated system of air cavities. The remarkable structure can be seen in the unmounted skeleton of Camarasaurus, another amphibious dinosaur. The teeth of the Brontosaurus indicate that it was an herbivorous animal feeding on soft vegetable food. Three opinions as to the habitat of the amphibious dinosaurs have been held by scientific authorities. The first, advocated by one Professor Owen, who described the first specimens found 60 years ago, 1841 to 1860, and, supported especially by Professor Cope, have been most generally adopted. This regards the animals as spending their lives entirely in shallow water, partly immersed, wading about on the bottom, or perhaps occasionally swimming, but unable to emerge entirely onto dry land. More recently, Professor Osborne has advocated the view that they resorted occasionally to the land for egg-laying or other purposes, and still more recently the view has been taken by Mr. Riggs and the late Professor Hatcher that they were chiefly terrestrial animals. One writer inclines that the view of Owen and Cope, whose unequaled knowledge of comparative anatomy renders their opinion on this doubtful question especially authoritative. The contrast between massive structure of the limb bones, ribs, and tail, and the light construction of the backbone, neck, and skull suggests that the animal was amphibious, living briefly in shallow water where it could wade about on the bottom, feeding upon the abundant vegetation of the coastal swamps and marshes, and pretty much out of the reach of the powerful and active carnivorous dinosaurs who were its principal enemies. The water could almost buoy up the massive body and prevent its weight from pressing too heavily on the imperfect joints of the limb and foot bones, which were covered during life with thick cartilage, like the joints of whales, sea lizards. What? What are sea lizards? And other aquatic animals. If the full weight of the animal came onto these imperfect joints, the cartilage would yield and the ends of the bones would grind against each other, thus preventing the limb from moving without tearing the joint to pieces. The massive, solid limb and foot bones weighted the limbs while immersed in water and served the same purpose. As the lead in a diver's shoes, enabling the Brontosaurus to walk about firmly and securely underwater. On the other hand, the joints of the neck and back are exceptionally broad, well-fitting, and covered with a much thinner surface of cartilage. The pressure was thus much better distributed over the joint, and the full weight of the part of the animal above the water, reduced as it was by the cellular construction of the bones, might be borne on these joints without the cartilage giving way. Or shall we add the wand to make things more interesting? Looking at the mounted skeleton, we may see that if a line be drawn from the hip joint to the shoulder blade, all the bones below are this massive. All above, including the neck and head, are lightly constructed. This line may have taken to indicate the average water line, so to speak, of this leviathan of the shallows. The long neck would enable the animal, however, to wade to a considerable depth. Oh, I might forage for food either in the branches or the tops of the trees. And more probably among them, the soft, succulent water plants on the bottom. The row of short, spoon-shaped, stubby teeth around the... Oh, fuck. Around the front of the mouth would serve to bite or pull off soft leaves and water plants. But the animal evidently could not masticate its food and would have swallowed without chewing, as do modern reptiles and birds. Oh, fuck. I'm so nervous. Oh, shit. Oh, fuck. Oh, shit. Fuck. The brain case occupies only a small part of the back of the skull, so that the brain must have... Yes. And its organization. Yes. Only a small part of the brain case indicates a very low grade of intelligence. Fuck. I can barely even fucking read it. Shit. Much larger than the brain proper was the spinal cord, especially in the region of the sacrum, controlling most of the reflex and involuntary actions of the huge organism. I almost said orgasm. Okay, let's get to the end of the paragraph. Hence, we can best regard the Brontosaurus as a great slow-moving animal automaton, a vast storehouse of organized matter directed chiefly or solely by instinct, and to a very limited degree, if at all, by conscious intelligence. Its huge size and its imperfect organization, compared with the great quadrupeds of today, rendered its movements slow and clumsy. Its small and low brain shows that it must have been automatic, instinctive, and unintelligent. What a phrase to end on. Thank you for listening, GWA. I hope you're having a great day. Bye.